world tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greetings, friends around the world. Well, some of the most sophisticated weapons that the United States is capable of manufacturing are securely in the hands of some of the very nations we may find ourselves warring against one of these days. We seem to have been on a vast arms binge in the last few years to the point the arsenal of democracy has become one of the greatest arsenals in its sales to foreign nations abroad that the world has ever known. We are by far and away the largest dealer in arms that the world has ever known. The other day I was telling a group of people, just by way of comparison, about the capability of some of the super sophisticated weapons we are selling nations such as Saudi Arabia, Iran, and others, especially in the Middle East, where the big arms race is underway that makes that part of the world the most heavily militarized of any other part of this earth. And of course, one of the most dangerous places where confrontation between the big powers is likely, and where the spark which might ignite World War III, first conventional and ultimately, no doubt, nuclear bomb World War III, very likely could be ignited. There are a few interesting comparisons that perhaps would illustrate the point about the tremendous potential of some of these weapons we are selling some of these Arab nations. I suppose a lot of people who are familiar with jet flight, and there are no doubt millions who by now have traveled in jet airplanes in our modern age of jet travel, who have been aboard the big 747s, DC-10s, L-1011s, the 707s, and all the rest, 727s. And they're perhaps somewhat familiar with the fact that by, oh, say, 20 to 30 minutes into the flight, the captain will call that they are level at their cruising altitude of maybe 35, 37, or 39,000 feet. Well, as I was telling some people about the Fanjet Falcon that I'm privileged to fly, we, on a pretty good day, would maybe get to 37,000 feet in about 35 minutes. That's very good, believe me, because oftentimes, depending upon the weight of the cabin, how many people and baggage we have aboard, and of course the fuel load, which is nearly always full if we're going cross-country to Big Sandy, Texas or somewhere, well, we're loaded so heavily that we can't go right straight to 37 without burning off some at some other lower altitude. It's pretty difficult to go right straight on up there sometimes. But if you get an average in a modern corporate jet, and I'm not talking about the Lears or others, and I'll talk about the G2 in just a moment, if you get an average of about 1,000 feet per minute all the way to cruise altitude, you're doing quite well. You'll travel initially at, oh, 3,000, even 4,000 feet a minute or more down in your lower elevations. By the time you're out of about 18,000 feet, well, you've slowed down to perhaps about 1,500 feet a minute or a little more. Out of about 23,000 or so, you're going to slow down to about 1,000 feet a minute. Out of 31,000, you'll be slowing down clear to 500 feet a minute. So it equals out to approximately 1,000 feet a minute, and maybe you could plan on 35 minutes to 35,000 feet. Now, if you were flying a Grumman Gulfstream II, that's a bigger corporate jet, they quote 41,000 feet from a standing start at the end of the runway in 14 minutes. Now that, you know, to a person flying a Falcon, it takes him 35 minutes to 35,000 feet, sounds pretty exciting. A Learjet does similarly, and I don't want to quote the statistics since I don't have them here, and I might get a letter from Learjet. But I'll tell you, it's a hot rod of an airplane so far as climb is concerned, can go booming right on up to 41,000 feet in a real hurry. Then there is the F-15. That's that twin-tailed Grumman fighter, which has replaced the F-111 and has been able to out-dogfight an F-4 Phantom. Now, when I first went up to Point Mugu, when that program was still under evaluation by the two services, both the Navy and the Air Force, and they had an F-14 Tomcat up there, and it's a swing-wing, twin-tail, twin-jet fighter bomber that is an unbelievable performer. Now, hold on to your seat, because let me tell you something about that airplane. They have published this much about it, that the F-15 will go from a standing start at the end of the runway to over 98,000 feet in just under 3.5 minutes. Now, you know, the other day they had a special on television where they were showing the training program of some of the people who have to live in Iran. You heard about the Americans being killed over there recently, of course. And I think much publicized have been some of the difficulties of the American community of technicians, advisors of Grumman and Air Force and other personnel with their families and children, and how they have to live in a society which, for all practical purposes, is just one step this side of a complete agrarian, nomadic society of the villagers and the lifestyles that have gone on unchanged for thousands of years, so far as anyone knows. And they were showing that some of those who are now to fly these super-sophisticated aircraft, these weapon systems, come right straight out of these same villages, that bridging the gap between virtual illiteracy into some form of education, college, of course, the military, the academy, coming over to the United States to study, it doesn't mean that all those who are flying for the Shah of Iran are a bunch of illiterate villagers. I'm just saying that Grumman itself and others have indicated that the gap of coming from a comparatively rustic and rural background without the background of step-by-step in various other systems and suddenly finding yourself as a pilot in a supersonic, ultra-sophisticated weapons delivery system which has so many incredible potentials, so many different systems that you have to become completely expert at, is quite a giant step, quite a leap. And they're finding a lot of training difficulties. Now, at the present time, of course, the United States has quite a number of Arab pilots of many different nations at various U.S. Air Force bases where they are in training, learning how to fly these aircraft. But the special that was done by one of the TV networks recently showed not only the completion of the aircraft, it showed the formal unveiling of the aircraft in the hangar and Grumman and other diplomats talking to representatives of the Iranian government, how they took delivery. The first flight was followed all the way across the North Atlantic and on down to Iran. The arrival of the aircraft there, delivery into the hands of the Iranian pilots. I don't know, I guess when you think back a few years when we, the general public, didn't know about the tremendous new development of American fighter aircraft in World War II until suddenly the Germans were shocked out of their socks to find out we had a long-range fighter aircraft in the F-47 and the P-51s that could follow those B-17s and B-24s all the way to Berlin and back. And we didn't in those days, of course, struggling for our lives in a global conflict of world war, for one moment think that we would take the most ultimate, sophisticated, supersonic aircraft that the human ingenuity could ever design and sell them by the hundreds to potential enemies. Now, of course, they're not enemies now. We're supposed to have very good relations with the Shah of Iran. And, of course, this is one thing that keeps those good relations going, is the fact that we're willing to sell the Shah of Iran sophisticated hovercraft, jets, helicopters capable of operation in zero-zero visibility, destroyers of the most modern class, even before we deliver that same class to our own Navy, that we are willing to sell loads of sophisticated weapons to some of these Arab countries before those weapons manufacturers are able to fill orders from our own Marine Corps, or Army, or Air Force, or Navy. But of course, if you listen to the people talking about the dollars and cents of it, and I don't mean Prince Bernhard or other people such as in Japan, where some of the leaders of the world have been seen with nothing but their posterior protruding out of Lockheed funds barrels, I mean just a straightforward above-the-table exchange of monumental amounts of money because the United States is the biggest arms trafficker the world has ever seen. Maybe you did, maybe you didn't see the interesting little quip that came along in Art Buchwald's column recently about what Henry allegedly did on his vacation. But he claimed that the State Department makes everyone write an essay when he or she comes back from vacation, and he claims this is the one that Henry Kissinger wrote. Now, this is all tongue-in-cheek, of course. Everyone knows that the satire and the dry humor of Art Buchwald, he makes a lot of people very mad, by the way. When we carried his column in The Plain Truth for quite a few months, we had letters pro and con like you couldn't believe. Some people, I guess, thought the man had come to work for us. They honestly didn't know he's a syndicated columnist whose articles appear in newspapers, magazines all over the country and in other countries too. But
At any rate, he had quite an interesting one on how Henry allegedly wrote he went to Iran on his summer vacation, met a new friend named Shah. He's a very nice person. We had a lot of fun together in his palace. He says, Shah likes to play with missiles and airplanes and specially fitted destroyers and tanks and guns and toys like that. And he asked me if there were any toys we had in America that he didn't have. Henry said that he told him we had a lot of toys that he would love, and he said he'd like to buy some. So he claimed that his friend the Shah had a very big allowance, and he said he would give him $10 billion if he would send him some new toys. And Henry said he told him it wouldn't be any problem at all. All he had to do was to give him a shopping list. He'd go to the toy store in the Pentagon and buy some for him. He said the Shah seemed to be happy because he said that if he couldn't buy the toys in America, he was going to buy them someplace else. Henry allegedly said that he told the Shah that America makes the best toys there are. And besides that, they're all brand new, and they can do things that no foreign toys could duplicate. Some of them had lasers, and others were controlled electronically, and still others had heat-seeking devices on them that could blow other people's toys to bits. He then claimed that the Shah got very excited and said maybe he ought to buy $15 billion worth instead of $10 billion. And I told him that was a very good idea. I described the new American toy airplane called the F-16 fighter and another called the F-18. They were so new that American kids didn't even have them yet. He said he liked that, according to this fictitious letter from Henry that Art Buchwald came up with, and he said he would buy as many of them as I could get my hands on. Then he asked me if there were any new toy ships that would be coming out for Christmas. And so Henry allegedly said, I told him about a guided missile attack frigate that could fire 20 missiles at one time in 20 different directions. His eyes lit up as he made me promise that I would send a dozen of them as soon as they were available. He also told me how much he loved submarines, and I said he would go nuts over the submarine toys that had just been designed. They could stay underwater for months at a time, and he got so excited he bought me an ice cream soda. Then he asked me if I could get him 25 nuclear energy plants for his playroom. And I said that they were considered dangerous toys, and his stores couldn't sell them to him unless they could control the waste material that the plants made, because if it got in the wrong hands, it might hurt somebody. He got very angry at this, and he said he didn't want to play with me anymore, and if he couldn't have the waste material for himself, he wasn't going to play, so I told him I would try to work something out if he promised to be very careful with the waste material and not tell anybody what he was going to do with it. He apologized for getting mad and said he would probably buy another $5 billion worth of toys next year and maybe $5 billion more the year after that. So Art Buchwald's column concludes with this tongue-in-cheek and yet very grisly, very grim, very deadly alleged interchange between Henry Kissinger and the Shah of Iran. And of course it didn't quite go like that, and yet you can't help but look at it as a lot of toys, and yet with deadly serious potential for the entirety of the world. His concluding paragraph was, he said, I never saw a kid who had so much money to buy toys in my life. We had a swell dinner, and the next morning, as I left, he gave me a World War II collection of bubblegum cards as a going-away present. I thought that was real nice of him, because I really hadn't done anything to deserve it. I like buying toys for other people. It makes me feel I've done something to earn my vacation. End of article by Art Buchwald. You know, it's crazy in this election year, when you're so torn, you hear Senator Monsdale come out and really flail away at U.S. sales of sophisticated arms abroad, and I, for one, agree with him right down the line on that. Yet, on the other hand, you hear other very vague statements issuing from the Carter camp. You're not quite sure what he says and what he meant, if he meant what he said or said what he meant. And you're kind of torn between. On the one hand, you like the stability of government and you like the record of the past, and in other ways, you're a little worried about it. You're kind of torn back and forth. Now, I'm not involved in politics, and I'm not taking part in any candidates one way or the other, so I'd like to just say in advance that in case some of the remarks I make in the next few months seem to harmonize with either or both of the various contending camps of the Democrats and the Republicans as they strive to get their candidate elected in each case, of course, for the first time, you have to remember that, the public office, why, I'm not responsible for that. But I happen to think that it's absolutely ridiculous and nothing short of obscene, as well as hideously dangerous for the United States of America to be in the arms business, selling arms to erratic leaders of foreign nations abroad. to terrorists the world over. Of course, Libya's president, Muammar Gaddafi, is supposedly a generous patron who shovels out arms and money to terrorist organizations and to other countries such as Idi Amin's Uganda, in much the same way that the United States is shoveling out arms to nations such as Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and other countries in the Persian Gulf area, as well as Iran. But Gaddafi is a dangerous, erratic troublemaker who has been very clearly labeled by the Israeli ambassador to the United Nations as being behind a tremendous amount of the financing of international terrorism. And we now happen to live in the world where terrorism is beginning to have overtones of eventually going nuclear, where it's not unlikely that at some time nuclear shipments could be hijacked, that nuclear weapons-carrying systems could be stolen or hijacked. Now we realize that Libya is being charged in involvement in a Palestinian terrorist attack on an Israeli airliner at Istanbul on August 11th, where four people were killed and 30 others wounded. And, of course, two of the captured terrorists were quoted as saying that Libya financed the operation. President Sadat, who happens to know the man well, describes Gaddafi as a mental case. President Nimiri calls him a madman. And yet others attribute his actions to his almost fanatical brand of Muslim nationalism, which is to say religion and nationalism are mixed. But, of course, he is very quick to condemn what he calls terrorism from the various imperialist international Zionists, and he talks about racism on their part. Well, in that Third World Conference down in Colombo, Sri Lanka, you heard of, no doubt, Gaddafi recently was speaking before them and claiming that he supports terrorism that is equated with a struggle for a people for independence for a just cause. But he denied that he favors kidnapping and robbery. He claimed that such criminal terrorist acts would be punished in Libya, but he definitely said that he would support any kind of terrorism such as the struggle of the people of Rhodesia against the white government there of Ian Smith. He said we would support that if that is terrorism, because he claimed it would be the support of a just cause. Take a look at the Middle East today and see what you see. The traditionally stable nation, the banking and industrial capital, at least the economic capital, and a very, very wonderful tourist playground right there in the Middle East, the one place to which most Americans, Britons, Europeans, and others would go first, because it was the place from which they could go, even in the pre-67 Six-Day War years, to an Arab country and gain access to other Arab countries, and then perhaps go through Jerusalem and on into Israel. That was the only way you could do it in those years, remember, because you couldn't go to Israel, get your passport stamped, and then be allowed access to any of the Arab countries, including Lebanon. But Lebanon was quite peaceful and stable in those days. Now look at it. Virtually ceased to exist as a nation. Hundreds of firms and various individuals, of course, have fled not only to Cairo and created a tremendous problem there, as I reported from on the spot early in the spring of this year, but also to other areas in the Middle East, not the least of which is Kuwait, where they have tried to set up business because the financial capital that was available in Lebanon has had to flee to other areas, and the nation is virtually prostrate in the ongoing civil strife between political and religious, primarily with religious overtones, elements between Muslims and so-called Christians. Maybe I should say so-called Muslims to make it even. But here is this tinderbox of the Middle East, with Iran up there to the northeast of the area of Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, Israel, and all the others. Then here's Saudi Arabia getting shipments of sophisticated U.S. arms. Other nations in the Middle East are also benefiting, and not only is the United States supplying sophisticated weaponry in the form of supersonic jet aircraft, hovercraft, that's troop-carrying hovercraft. You know what those are? I'm not just talking about helicopters. I'm talking about just like a great big would be like an amphibious boat of some sort, which would have huge fans on it, which could actually ride over the surface of the water at a very low level and come ashore, ride over barriers, obstacles, sand dunes, and even low-level hills and so on, carrying troops on a cushion of air. Now, such military vehicles already exist and are operational, and the United States has been selling them to Iran, you see. I want to make that point here before I go on, because some people may think I'm talking about helicopters when I say hovercraft. No, I'm talking about a troop-carrying device that is ultra-sophisticated. It is absolutely unbelievable, I suppose, if you saw one hovering along over the water and then just come right up on the beach and still riding on a cushion of air. So here the United States, as well as France, West Germany, Belgium, Britain, and other nations are just pouring arms into the Middle East until it is the most heavily militarized area on the face of this earth. Now, in the meantime, some of the most unstable rulers the world has ever seen are having a great deal to do with the Middle East. Idi Amin, who is an absolute imbecile, reported by some people in the last stages of syphilis. And you can believe it when you see some of the absolute idiotic things he has done. The rape of that university down there because his illiterate son was being snubbed by some of the students, was making advances at gunpoint, and apparently was raping some of the co-eds at gunpoint together with his bodyguards. And because he didn't like being snubbed, he reports to Daddy at Big Dada. You know, he's got the title of field marshal, professor, doctor, and president. He is his own foreign minister. I think he's another couple of ministers in the government. Has a chest full of fruit salad that he designed out of somebody's used drapery material for non-existent battles in non-existent places, and calls himself a hero. Rides around, of course, in his black limousine. But this imbecile in charge of a government responsible for the murder of, who knows, some people estimate up to 250,000 human beings, went in with his bodyguards and his various army units and absolutely wiped out this university. They claim that hundreds died in a bloodbath, and the remaining students were so terrified they simply faded away into the outback and into the forest. Now they're claiming that people in the cities, and especially in Tebbi, are trying to get back out to the bush and to live the life of the simple villagers. There are roadblocks at all the intersections on every road, and you can't tell who is who, because they claim only a portion of the troops are any more loyal to Amin. There have been attempts on his life. It is claimed he never sleeps in the same bed twice. He always tries to avoid pre-programming his movement because he's in terror of his own life. The guy is so irrational. He's an absolute Hitlerian, tyrannical, irrational ruler who is living in a fog of utter imbecilic indecision. And yet he's got his hands on sophisticated weapons. Well, thankfully, the Israelis took care of a good portion of his arms by blasting out of existence some of his MiG-21s or 23s where they sat at Entebbe's airport in their raid when they released some of the captured people aboard that France Airbus. By now, you've read, of course, of that long since. But here, having a great deal to do with Israel in the Middle East, are not only this Idi Amin, who could, of course, be overthrown, toppled, assassinated, blown to bits, or whatever by the time you hear this broadcast, because I don't know how long, you know, he can expect to remain in power with what he has been doing to that country down there. But you also have this Gaddafi over in Libya, who is financing international terrorism around the world, primarily, of course, aimed at the nation of Israel. And he's down sounding off in Colombo recently before the non-aligned third world in their fifth summit conference, and he was replying publicly for the first time to published accusations attributed to Western diplomatic sources that he is the financier behind various international terrorism. Of course, he blames the accusations on imperialism, on international Zionism, and on racialism. And then he turns around to claim that it's an honor for them to support the Palestinian terrorism as they make war, my words, my comment, on women and children, on free international citizens of free nations, of the United States, of Britain, West Germany, Belgium, Holland, France, other countries in the Middle East, including Israel, as they are merely going about the business of going on vacation, of indulging in the very harmless act of tourism, of taking their families back and forth to their places of work or what have you, in an international air carrier, and he is standing up and supporting the act of terrorizing these people. He said, if the Palestinian people, who have been expelled from their territory in 1948, if their struggle is terrorism, then we accept this accusation, and it is an honor to us because we support oppressed and colonized people for the restoration of their land and independence and sovereignty. Now, that's a hypocritical statement if you ever heard one. How can you believe when you see various terrorist organizations who are not trying to wage a war of words, who are not trying to sit down with the various parties over the conference table? They're not trying to arrange conferences. They're not trying to attend various summit meetings. They're not trying to negotiate politically. But they are forming terrorist organizations for acts of criminal murder, assassination, kidnappings, and brutality against harmless wayfarers, women, and little babies. And this character, Muammar Gaddafi, claims that's an honor to be involved with them. He was wearing a black fez, flowing robe, and sunglasses, and he dealt at length with allegations that he was instigating terrorism. He claimed that the Third World must not be misled with regard to the meaning of terrorism in order to make us give up our struggle against imperialism and colonialism. Zionists are terrorists, he said. It is they who attack schools in the Middle East. I think he was referring to the attack by Israeli commandos on a school where young Jewish children were being held captive by a group of Arab terrorists, thus lending a little bit of additional bitter bile to the hypocrisy of this enormous and grotesque figure of would-be despotism in the nation of Libya. But I suppose that that kind of rationale escapes that kind of a person. He said it is they who attack properties. This is terrorism. And I think he referred then to the alleged attack of property, meaning the destruction of Russian MiGs parked at Entebbe Airport, the destruction of military equipment in Entebbe as they were releasing Jewish people who had been singled out with other nationalities already allowed to go free. So he claims that the Zionists, as he calls them, are those who attack properties. This is terrorism. He said the terrorists over the city of Cairo and their planes when they killed people and workers in factories, this is terrorism. The United States wishes to terrorize the Libyan people. I say the man is an abject, grotesque liar. I don't think there is one human being from Poughkeepsie to Pasadena who wants to terrorize a Libyan. But I am reminded that some of the lines in our own Marine Corps hymn, from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli, remind me that in history that nation was one which imposed impossible tariffs, acts of piracy, and international terrorism on peaceful sailing vessels indulging in trade, which resulted at that time in American history by a reaction that was far more like the reaction the Israelis have been dishing out on nations who would dare to tread on them than the reaction the United States of America has been showing in the past few years. No, the man is an abject liar. There isn't a United States citizen from Poughkeepsie to Pasadena who wants to terrorize any Libyans. But they don't want Libyans financing or supporting terrorists who are waging war on women and children either. Well, I'm not going to have time to take you through some of this Matthew 24 prophecy that shows you exactly what is happening in the Middle East right now and what is going to happen in the future. But I wish you'd get your name on the mailing list of the Plain Truth magazine and find out what these world events really mean and where are we headed, what's going to happen in the Middle East. Is the Middle East going to be a hotbed where war breaks out again in the months and the years just ahead? What about a future Arab oil embargo and what that will do to the economy of the West? Write for your current number, or better yet, call the toll-free number, 800-423-4444, for your free copy of The Plain Truth. And in my Speaks Out column, just about all you've heard now on Edie Dada Amin, too, coming along in the next issue or so. The address again in just a moment. It's free of charge. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow with Garner Ted Armstrong, sponsored by the Worldwide Church of God. For literature offered on this program, send your requests along with the call letters of this station to Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123. Or you may dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444.